Well, some of you may be surprised to know that Tim Gordon, myself, Taylor Marshall, were not professional broadcasters. We're actually writers, and we've gotten into this funny world of YouTube videos. And Tim and I actually met. We've never actually met in person. People are surprised to hear. I've never shaken the man's hand ever. Yeah, they don't like that. They don't like to think that in this universe we've never had a beer together or given a high five in real life, just virtual. But we met because of his book that came out, Catholic Republic, and we talked on the phone, and I heard him out. We talked about the book, and we did a show. When was that, Tim? Then we did the first show together, and we talked about Catholic Republic.
We talked back last June of 2018, and we had a good chat about natural yep. law, which is really the book's central theme, as we'll talk, I guess, a little later. And you had to go to your Way of St. James.
That's right. I went off to Spain.
Walk. Yeah, I went off to Spain, and then you're like, let's talk in 3 weeks, and we did. And I think shortly after, I think it was late July, we did the first, our first ever TNT. Yep. Though it be not called that at the right. at that point.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And
on the book. So
I think I can't even remember the name of that show. But it was okay. You know, it wasn't big like some of the ones we've done since then. But since then it's been picked up by Sophia Institute Press. And we both got book deals on Sophia Institute in the last several months, and I just finished my book, Infiltration, put in the third round of edits yesterday before the end of the day. And your book's about to run. It's about to go live, right?
It is as second in its second edition with a whole new round of edits. Edits, the fun part as writers.
Man, edits the worst part, isn't it? Writing the book.
The worst.
This is my ninth book to write. And to write them is fun. I really enjoy it. There's moments when I just go to a coffee shop. And I put on headphones and I just phase out for like 8 hours. And that's a good part. I mean, there's parts where like, I just love what I do. This is great, you know? And as you're doing the research, you're learning things and you're putting it on paper and oh, people are going to love this. This is great. It's just a fun process. And then when you get to the edits and you're looking at it for the eighth time, you know, and you're reading it over, or you got an editor saying, this doesn't make sense, or we don't like this. You know, it's kind of a punch to the gut a little bit.
It is. It can feel really counterproductive. It's as long as it's very abstract, you have to abstract to the notion that whatever they pull out is for the betterment of the book and you are writing better. But since it's sculpture, see, when you're writing, what guys like us, you know, natural born writers like is sculpture by addition. When you're doing sculpture by subtraction, at the end in the editing process, it feels inherently negative.
That's right.
It feels like, no, you're taking away, you want to take away half a chapter, but it is good. And it is like, if you have a really fastidious editor, that's like, this is bad, but the rest of the book is good. And as long as you trust the editor, then it's reassuring because you're like, he said the rest of the book is good and it'll have this, you know, thematic unity throughout if I get rid of X, Y, or Z.
Right.
It's negative, though. It feels very bad.
Yeah, it's kind of like Easter Sunday. You get in your, like, suit, you know, you're, like, ready to go to Mass. You walk out, and your wife's like, are you going to wear that tie? I mean, you look great, honey, but are you going to wear that tie? And you're like, well, no. I was going to put on a different tie. Right? Because you think you look good. You think you're ready to go. Like, okay, it's Easter Sunday. And then, you know, someone you trust says, yeah, it's a good looking suit. Everything's looking good. But a tie's a no-go. So you got to change it.
Or you put on your favorite cologne and someone's like, is the dog go to the bathroom in the house? Or what's up? And you're like, yeah, I know. Gross. This is my joke. Get it? You know, like, it's never not personal because writing is such a, you know, aspirational writers out there. It is such a personal process. You know, you're bringing a unique, no matter what kind of book you're writing, not whether fiction or nonfiction, and even across the variant genres of nonfiction, it's always personal. Even if you're just writing a history of something, you put those categories together, those chapters, the phraseologies together in a unique way. It's uniquely you. And it's one of the few times we'll say that on TNT, and it's not like postmodernism. You'll write it. There's a million ways to skin a cat. And even if it's you, a conservative Catholic, versus your best friend, another conservative Catholic, and you're both writers, you will put a book together on the same topic in totally different ways.
That's right.
And so the editing process is inherently like cutting. That's what it editing is.
Yeah. You know, the most nervous I've ever been on any of my books was my first fiction book, Sword and Serpent, because that was like, that is my soul. Like those are my made up stories, like my mind. It's my playfulness. So to throw that out there into the public sphere and then have people make fun of it, it's pretty scary to think about, you know? Fortunately, most people like it, and it's good. So by the time I did the third fiction book in the series, I knew that there was fans and they were going to like it and they were pumped up. But the first one, I was really nervous. And to be honest, I'm a little nervous about my new book. I was talking to Joy about it last night, Infiltration, just because it's so raw and it's going to be so controversial and there's so much bad stuff in it, you know, about the infiltration of the Catholic Church. And you're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. And you're emotionally going to want to reject the book because you don't want to accept it.
But is that a different kind of anxiety than you have with Sword and Serpent? Because Sword and Serpent is that.
It feels the same. That's why I told Joy. I said, this feels like before Sword and Serpent launched.
Really? Yeah. I'm surprised to hear you say that.
Yeah, I am too.
The same kind.
I am too. But
just.
Yeah, I just know that this is a big book, you know, and I've never written anything like it. But I feel like it's researched. I stand by it. It's good. So anyway, let's talk about Catholic Republic. I have the old version here, but the new version's coming out. It's got a happy cover. It's got an American flag added to it.
The color scheme. I think it's Charlie's wife that actually did this. She did a bang up job, and we both know Charlie over at Sophia Institute. Charlie, good morning to you. If you end up watching Charlie. This, it reminds me of that part in 310 to Yuma when Ben Wade is seeing his old gang through the window of the hotel, and he goes, "Charlie, boys," to Charlie Prince. It's really interesting because, for one thing, the covers it is beautiful. It's a little happier. It's more.
I like
more
it better. Tones of, I'll be honest. I like
you
it
like
better.
It better.
Yeah.
Well, so the
because this I looks mean, like have, this looks like a fog. Like it's ominous. This is ominous.
It is ominous. Yeah. It is ominous. There's, which is probably imprint based theme. The theme at Dangerous Books, which I mean, it's kind of halfway interesting to talk about the provenance of this book in terms of just where it's been, all the different publication houses. So maybe if you don't mind, I'll talk about that.
Yeah, tell us the history of this book. Well, first of all, people are watching, like, they may not even know that you had a book, Tim. I mean, just real quick, in 1 minute, if you can do 1 minute. I know Tim Gordon, he likes to do the 5 minute, but if you can do 1 minute, what is this book about? And then let's talk about how it came into being and got floated.
Yeah. So this book is a series of chapters that came to me as revelations, you know, natural revelations, not supernatural.
The Island of Patmos.
Yeah, right. Not that kind of thing. I'm not Joannine. But going directly from licentiate in doctoral studies in philosophy to law school, which I did because of circumstances in my family's life and my life. I had a unique opportunity, particularly going from philosophic studies to constitutional law studies. So basically 4 or 5 of those chapters came as like, oh my gosh, moments that I experienced when I was in grad school or law school, something about the natural law, the way it descends. It's all about natural law and the American Republic. And the big premise of the book is simply that the religious right and the secular left, the way we think of them as opposites in America, is inherently flawed and inherently shocking when you get my premise, which is the religious right is none other than the grandkids of the Protestant Reformation. The secular left are the grandkids of the Enlightenment. And together, the Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment gave us the at least the personages of the early country. They gave us the peoples as well, not just the ratifiers of the Declaration and the Constitution. And the Reformation and the Enlightenment, further to that, were each responses to Catholicism, but in the formation of the new American Republic, 1760s, 70s, 80s, they were ripping off their hated rival, Roman Catholicism, when they came to find very starkly that the ideas of natural rights, chapter one, subsidiarity, chapter two, virtue ethics, chapter three, church-state relations, chapter four, a family-based economy, chapter five, and in the science and technology sector, chapter six, can't be done from a Protestant or an Enlightenment perspective, because those are the respectively the Christian and the secular responses to the Catholic natural law, to Aristotomism. So they're ripping off Aristotle, Thomas, and the Thomistic Jesuits in the early Republic. And it turns out to be the shocker premise because, of course, America is the Protestant nation founded to keep Catholicism out using nothing but Catholic ideas.
Legit. So you write this book. You don't have a publisher for it. You write it out and then you start floating it around?
So I wrote the book. I got the book a book deal with Catholic Answers Press, Catholic Answers of, you know, Catholic Answers fame, the summer of 2013, the summer that I was supposed to be studying for the bar, you know, and I kind of cut out hours there because I knew I wasn't going to practice law for much longer than a year, and I didn't end up doing it. But summer I graduated law school. Spring before I graduated law school, I went to a Catholic Answers gala dinner in San Diego because I went to law school in San Diego. Met the guys, talked to them about everything I'd been studying, and they're like, "You should do a book. We want this book." And so I put together a proposal right as I graduated. Got it together, first chapter, and they put me on contract to write it. Immediately thereafter, I had the summer where I was supposed to be studying for the bar, and I did get a law job, which takes 60 of your hours a week. And, you know, I knew I wanted to get out, but I had to put in a year or so of it. And it was very hard to write. I had a year on contract to write it, but I ended up going over a year just because I was so – I know – it's not like teaching theology where your head's in the ideas anyway.
Right.
You'd think – the practice of law would conduce to it because some of the chapters are on constitutionalism, but it wasn't that kind of law. Property and water law, you know, it's not fun stuff. So it took me 2 years to write the thing. I turned the thing in on Halloween of 2016, I think. And I don't hear back from the boys at Catholic Answers Press. And I have many friends over there still. We talk about differences of opinion you and I have with respect to current events in this pontificate. But I have many friends over at Catholic Answers still, good people. And even notwithstanding what I'm about to say, don't hear back from between Halloween and like, it was like one of the last days of school that school year that I was teaching. It was May, early May. And they just said, yeah, this is too controversial. We're not going to publish this. It's too political, too fringy. And I was like, well, can we go over, you know, so it was a clean break.
Can we do some more edits?
yeah. Can we do some, I mean, that's what I said. I was right. Like, wow, I'm a first time author, you know? Yeah. So I thought you would come back at me with some edits. I thought that we would, you know, this was a process, and they're just like, yeah, but the upshot of the book is, you know, two parts politics, one part Catholic. I'm like, I mean, it's all Catholic, but they're like, yeah, but we thought it would be more like one part Catholic, two parts politics. I mean, they didn't say it in those exact terms, but I'm trying to give people a feel. That's I think what the problem ultimately was. And it's not.
Yeah, I mean, Catholic Answers is being, I mean, their strike zone is apologetics.
Apologetics.
Right.
But they knew it wasn't going to be apologetics all along. I was like, this isn't what this is. They're like, no, that's cool. We want to. Well, the long and the short of it, I wasn't going to mention it. It's public knowledge. They changed presidents in the 2 years, odd months that they went from Keating to Czech in that time period. And that, as any Seinfeld viewer knows, that can kill a deal, a change of president in a company. long and the short of it is, so I spent that summer rewriting the thing, redrafting it. You think, I mean, you talk about cutting your heart out as a writer, having a few edits. I went through and I rewrote with my blessed wife. I mean, just always on my side. She just helped me rewrite every sentence. To be fair, I think Steph was in on it.
Didn't know that.
She was in on, I mean, she had a major hand on the rewrite. All the research that I did for this book is my heart. My non-creative heart is just everything I was studying in grad school and law school. And I put it all into this book, and people can just go buy this book, literally. And you don't have to go to multiple years of graduate philosophy, grad school, or constitutional studies in law school. I studied at arguably the best place to study the Constitution in the world. We have the Originalist Society. Scalia comes and visits us every year. My mentor, Mike Rappaport's an amazing constitutional scholar. So people don't have to do all this. They have their lives. Literally just read my book. I mean, this is an unapologetic plug for my book because I stuck it all in there. And what Steph helped me to do that summer was to take it, and it was still in academic or legalese, philosophies or legalese, and to get it into really, really easy to read language. We just went through sentence by sentence, mm-hmm. and either said, yeah, this is fine, or let's just rework this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the book was essentially written twice with none of the, I mean, we did it sentence by sentence though. The second time it was grueling, but it wasn't hard because I didn't do any of the research again. And we just would go through a few pages a day. Yeah. My brother lived by us at the time, always wanted to go. We were both teachers, wanted to go hang out with our families, and we'd be doing 4 hours a day.
Yeah,
because I had all that.
It's a lot of work, and people need to think of a book as sitting down with the author and spending time. Like people say, man, it'd be so cool to like sit down with Aquinas or Augustine and just pick their brain, you know, at a coffee shop. You can do that. It's called pick up their book.
That's right.
And you're literally in their mind, hearing their exact words, and not just like off the cuff. You're hearing it polished and presented. So like if you wanted to sit down at a coffee shop and hear Tim Gordon make his argument in the most precise possible way, you get the book. And do you get this, Tim? Some people will say, hey, can I take you to lunch? I just want to pick your brain on Paul's epistles, you know, like the Catholic theology of Paul. And I think in my mind, well, I already spent hundreds of hours polishing that book in Catholic perspective on Paul. You're going to get nothing better. I mean, I might have some new insights than what I've done in that book. So just read the book. Like I can't tell you in an hour or 2 hours what I would tell you because I literally spent half a year prepping and writing that book. So that's my mind. That's what I got. That's like the dump, the download of my mind on Paul, on the epistles, Catholic theology, Catholic sacraments. That's it.
People love this idea of two things. People love the emotional tip. So they're like, yeah, but I think there'll be, and it's kind of related to what I was going to say, number two, people love esoterica. And people think in a kind of postmodern 2019 way that if they have lunch with you, now, and I'm not saying that there wouldn't be some extra nuggets, but they think that if they have lunch with you, there will be all this extra esoterica and they can ask questions like, well, how do you really feel about this? And you're like, I mean, chapter again,
eight.
Not to be
chapter eight. Yeah. It's
like, yeah. What about your footnotes in chapter eight? No, I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, I said how I really feel. I'm not trying to be curmudgeonly because sometimes I'm sure here's the thing. If it's a shrewd enough interlocutor that's like, I read the book twice, I have these extra questions.
Yeah.
Then you can be like, well, okay, this will probably be fruitful to you. But if it's just someone that's kind of halfway thumb through the book and it's like, can you just sort of give me the quick version? It's like, no, I mean, I really, particularly in the case of Catholic Republic, for instance, it was rewritten a second time. So it's like literally all the same points involving Thomism, Aristotelianism, virtue ethics, even some metaphysics, but it's dumbed so far down without losing the thread that people are like, wow, this is, I mean, go read it's, while they're still on Amazon in the first edition on Dangerous Books. I guess I should finish the story of how it bounced around in a minute. But while they're still up, go read. People are like, wow, this is a lot of philosophy and constitutional law. And it's like the easiest book to read ever. That's all Steph. So, yeah, so we spent the whole summer rewriting it. That next you know, got it done by the end of the summer. Gave it to
so are we now in 2017?
I guess we are in 2017. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, summer between the 2016-2017 school year. So still late 16. I went and saw a Church Militant event, saw Boris talk. We'd been introduced recently before that. And I gave him the manuscript, the new manuscript. And I said, hey, I think you'd be interested in this. And he was very interested. And so they were going to publish it. And this is sort of the beginnings of my relationship, my friendship with Michael Boris, which continues strong, even though they didn't end up publishing it. He was pumped about it. He's excited. And they carried it into early 2017. And they were planning to publish it. They hit a little financial snag. With their publication company, St. Michael's. It was small, but it's not a large publication anyway. So we kind of agreed. He said, hey, I'll push this thing. I'll do whatever I can for it, which he did, especially in the early stages. He pushed it hard, did some shows on it and all that. But I, you know, we can't do this. And it would be like 2019 before we got out the first version, which is kind of ironic. So let it go. And then I was just like, whatever, if I have the support of Boris, I'll put it out on Catholic half self-publishing. So I went to St. Leonine Publishing. It's called Leonine. I guess that's a third house. It's halfway a house, halfway self. And I was just like, whatever. And that's when Milo Yiannopoulos comes along. And through my relationship with Church Militant, I was kind of their letter writer or their defender. They liked my polemics. They had defended Milo in 2017. And then some of their audience went nuts, and I wrote a little op-ed, you know, defending their defense of Milo. And immediately Christine Niles was like, Milo loves this, you know, and wants to chat with you. So we chat. I think I emailed them. And funny story is I was like, this book is for your new imprint, because he had this imprint, Dangerous Books. He ran his first book on it. He ran Pamela Geller's book on the Muslim assassination attempt on her life in Garland, Texas, on it, because it was called Dangerous Books. It was for books that are great but too controversial to be published elsewhere. I was like, this is so perfect. And Milo's Catholic and loves flaunting it. So I sent it to them. I heard back from his former CEO, Alex McCriss, like immediately, but I didn't get the email got spammed. I nearly never connected with the people at Milo .inc because it spammed my email. I luckily just happened to find it a week and a half later. And he was like, we're probably going to run this. It was like two emails, three emails. He's like, we want to run this book. Have you found another home for it? And I called him the next day. I was like, no, yeah, we'd like this to work out. So yeah. And then it took a few months into 2018. Eventually it kind of bounced. It didn't bounce around, but it dallied a little bit in Dangerous's hands, but eventually came out 6 months later in February of 2018, and met a lot of people through the book. A lot of people, you know, guys like Pat Coffin were really supportive. You know, Boris continued to be. And then, of course, when Dangerous folded up, you and I were already talking to Charlie about some other books, your infiltration book. I have a similar topic with a wider historical perspective. Oops, sorry about that. That'll come out. I have the feminism book. So I have those two in the pipeline with Charlie. But he was interested in a third, in a second edition of this, which is what it'll be.
Legit. So I haven't seen the new one. I've only seen this one. Is it different? What percent of it is the same from the Dangerous one?
Textually?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's re-edited. It's got the same number count. You know, the introduction chapter, I call it chapter zero, is a basic, a beginner's guide to what is the natural law. I give it in three prongs. I did that in the first one. I still do this in the, you know, second one. And I just say, here's how this plays out in America. Whether you're religious right, doesn't include us Catholics on the right wing. It means right. Protestant right. Or secular left, here's how you reject, maybe with opposite motivations, but you end up with the same position, these three prongs of the natural law. And here's the only way to not reject the three prongs of the natural. So I do that in both books. The language is cleaner in this one. It went through a whatever that is after all those publication houses, each of whom applied their own copy editor, sixth copy editor, a very good one, you know, John Barger, mm-hmm. who we were just talking about, a good, smart man. And I did, you know, since it had been copy edited so many times before, I had him like be somewhat restrictive, not too many edits, but in some chapters more than others, I let him go nuts. Chapter one, chapter two, since it's the book's beginning. So the language is cleaner. You don't, I mean, more than anything, I'm not saying buy edition two because there's a gold ticket in every 500th copy. I'm saying buy it because there are, as of this morning, before we started rolling tape, there are 8 copies of the first edition left in Dangerous and Milo's storehouses, or whatever they're called. Yeah, collector's item. I bought a couple of the last ones just to have as a collector's item, and then it's gone. It's going to. So if you go Amazon search Catholic Republic, both titles will come up, but very soon, maybe by the time this show ends, I don't know. By the time this show airs, rather, it will only be the Sophia version. They have similar covers.
Right.
Mary, standing over the Capitol building, but the new one's a little bit cheerier, a little more red, white, and blue. The Milo one's a little more like a rainy day, you know. Yeah. There's consistency thematically to publication houses on those covers.
I like what Sophia did. I think it's a good improvement. I dig it.
Yeah,
I want to go back to the esotericism of being an author, right? And by esoteric, I'm not talking about a cult. I'm just in the original meaning of the word. It means secret knowledge, like secrets. Right. So often, especially when an author is persecuted or he's writing in a time when the ideas are not well received, he'll write in an esoteric way. He'll hint at things. And then when you meet him, you know, over a few drinks, he tells you what he really thinks.
Right.
So I've done that some, mainly in the fiction. You know, and like keen readers will say, hey, in book one on page 80, you said this, and in book three, you said this. I think that's connected. Is that true or not? And if they're a real like fan, I'll like tell them. Sometimes I just won't say, because like they'll say, is this character gay? I'm like, I'm not going to answer that. I never thought of that before. You know, like, so people come up with strange things. Right.
Yeah.
But do you think that we'll get to a time where Catholics have to write in an esoteric way? Like, could you have written Catholic Republic under a Muslim regime? Was violently, I mean, let's say we get to a point where if you publish anything contrary to the SSA agenda, anything contrary to abortion, anything contrary to euthanasia, anything contrary to trans or whatever, your book's going to be pulled.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's because it's so unapologetic and because... With that summer long rewrite that my wife helped me with, it's so unapologetically Catholic in its politics. This is the irony with Catholic Answers Press, is it is so thoroughgoingly Catholic. It's not two parts political, one part Catholic or whatever. I mean, it's Catholic in every page. It's showing that both the politics of the Declaration and the Constitution, you know, the breaking of the old regime with the Brits and then the making of the new American regime and then the culture of America, the early culture, the way it was supposed to be. I call that the third phase. You break, then you make the new regime, then you stake that new regime in the culture and the people have to carry it forward. All of these things are so, even notwithstanding the fact that it's, you know, peopled by Protestants in the early Republic, it's so Catholic. Because the culture of America really was about virtue ethics. And virtue ethics are Catholic. They're not Protestant. All of these things, even the economy, the early, particularly agrarian free enterprise economy of America depends on what's the driver, free will, free choice. Protestants don't even by and large, believe in free will. So, the idea of self-government in general. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I remember my mind's going back now to either our first or second video we did together. And we talked about how, you know, originally Protestantism in the mind of Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, Cranmer, Bucer, pick one. They are totally opposed to virtue ethics, totally opposed to what we would call Thomistic realism, natural law, all of those things because of just total depravity, right?
Right.
And the evisceration of human nature in sort of a really pessimistic Lutheran idea. And it's really only until you get to the Enlightenment and you get to the late 1700s where they're really throwing off their classic Protestantism.
Right.
You know,
the way,
so that enables them to then read some Jesuits, you know, read some Aristotle, read some Cicero, and begin to brick by brick put together something that appropriates or approximates our Catholic natural law tradition. So I think it's important for you people to hear. And I mean, you obviously explain that in the book, but you know, Tim's not saying that these Protestants just all of a sudden became Thomists, right? We're talking about this was sort of carried in by night, not in the open, but you know, you show in the book that many of these, you know, proto-American founding father thinkers are citing, reading, and quoting books that would have been contraband in Protestant countries 100 years prior.
Books that were actually contraband.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Algernon Sidney, who is kind of the Catholic books, a kind of Protestant codex of banned books. John Locke was not the first Whig of choice. Most kids know him because you study at least the name and some of the basic ideas of John Locke in middle school, high school. The first Whig that was really popular before John Locke for this English party of basically Protestant Enlightenment guys. It's the perfect mashup party. The party, the Americans who were revolutionaries were calling themselves American Neo-Whigs. They imagined themselves doing in the 1700s what the English Whigs had done, you know, after the English Civil War, before the restoration of William and Mary, the century before, whatever. All that's just boring history. But the Whigs are important to my analysis because they're the perfect mashup of guys like Locke, Protestant thought and Enlightenment thought. And they're the ones, even though they would be the most rabidly anti-natural law, because they're both Protestant and Enlightenment, which was really a repudiation of Aristotomism, natural law, like you said. They ended up being the Protestants in history most open to it, because what they really cared about was politics. And when what you really care about is politics, you need the natural law, particularly if you're talking about founding a new republic. So it turns out guys like Algernon Sidney, the first Whig of choice before Locke, was accused during his life of secretly ripping off Robert Bellarmine, who was a, you know, Thomistic Jesuit. And he actually was. Nathaniel Hawthorne, the American writer. There's even a great line in Scarlet Letter. I rip it and put it at the beginning of one of the chapters. Nathaniel Hawthorne talked about how these Puritan divines in the colonies were secretly reading, I don't have the exact line memorized, but they're secretly reading the monks and the fathers, you know, the patristics and the scholastics, even though they're supposed not to be. And the point is that you can't do natural law because, look, if you don't believe nature is a place of moral freedom, then you're not natural law. Both the Protestant Reformation rejected that and the Enlightenment rejected it. One, because of their view of, like you said, Taylor, total depravity. You can't believe in moral freedom if you're a total depravity Lutheran or Calvinist. You can't believe in moral freedom if, on the other side, you're an Enlightenment thinker who doesn't believe in such a thing as morality or true freedom, right? They're metaphysical principles. Prong number two, nature has to be intelligible if you are to be called a natural law thinker. How is a Protestant or an Enlightenment thinker going to qualify as believing nature is intelligible when for Protestants it's only the Bible and they're nominalists, who only believe in the words of the Bible in an ultimate sense, that completely reject natural theology. Karl Barth said it's from the devil. Yep. And on the other hand, just listen to Bill Maher or Bill Nye or any of the liberal bills on TV, right? they don't think there's anything intelligible about nature until they want to.
Yeah, it all goes back to Bill Ockham.
It goes back to Bill Ockham. No, it really does go back to Ockham, who was actually Catholic. It's kinda. Nominalism. Right. Kind of, yeah. I mean, he called himself a Catholic, unlike Bill Nye or Bill Maher. He said that no natural categories, no categories are natural. The categories of the human mind just kind of makes up a way to clean our room, our headspace.
Right. Well, it's just taking labels and label everything, but they're not really of their essence. There's no form to them. It's just, we're going to label everything. Cat, no. Chair, you know, sky, sun. And that's
mammal.
If you can, right. This is how I explain. People are like, oh, you guys are just talking about philosophy this way. No, listen, if your worldview is that of Occam, nominalism, not realism, which is Thomistic or Platonic or Aristotelian, that means that you can change and swap the labels. That means I can say, well, I'm a woman.
That's right.
I'm a man, but I don't believe in any like real masculinity or real femininity. So I'm just going to take masculinity off me and I'm going to put femininity on me. And now I'm a woman. Or you can say those three dudes are now in a marriage. I redefine it as three people and all male in certain situations. Right. That's now matrimony. You see, folks, if you buy into that philosophy of William of Ockham, that's 700 years old, or 600. In 2019, this is the kind of junk that goes on in the public discourse.
You it's apply serious. Like
ideas
swapping.
Matter, folks.
No, ideas matter. They drive history. People, Americans who have this anti-philosophical,
bogus,
intellectual tradition, kind of through the Calvinists. They really need to be awakened to that. I think my book's great there because it's so easy to read, but it's like. Yeah, absolutely. If you're a nominalist, you don't believe in real categories in nature. Then apply that to sexes, and then it's just you can be a woman. Apply it to marriage, and a man can marry a man. Apply it to even not just the sexes themselves, but femininity and masculinity, which is what happened in early feminism with the even first wave feminism. You just started saying, well, women can do man things, men can do women things. It eventually leads to applying a category of not femininity and masculinity, but females and males. And then after females and males, then it became marriage. And then all of a sudden you got transgender.
And you got, well, men can menstruate.
Right. Or carry a baby. You got men trying to carry a baby. It's wild. It comes directly from nominalism is now being vindicated, at least from the perspective of those who hate it. Like Thomas, like us.
Yeah, we see the natural outcome of it.
Yes. I mean, more in the last probably 20 years than ever before in history.
Right.
It's like the Big Bang. I talk about this in chapter 6 of my book. The Big Bang instantiates Augustine and the early fathers who believed in a creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. It took, 1,600 years for creation ex nihilo, the Catholic view of Genesis.
Right.
To be vindicated scientifically, but it got there. It got there. Yeah. Science gets there to the party. It just gets there late. Science will never contradict religion. This is why you need an Aristotelian view of true religion, the one true religion.
The one true religion, by which we mean the Catholic faith.
Right. It'll always get there, which is why the church is so pro-science and always has been. But a science and technology sector cannot be vindicated in a Protestant regime or an Enlightenment regime that doesn't believe that there are natural categories. You can't do good science.
That's right.
In the same way that Big Bang vindicated creation ex nihilo after the fact. Now, those who see plainly the transgender movement and the, you know, LGBT movement in general and the gay marriage movement,
feminism.
All that, which kind of goes together. Feminism is what I'm currently writing a book on. For Charlie and those guys, people who plainly see that for what it is realize, oh, this is the vindication of those who in, you know, 600 years ago rejected nominalism. Categories matter. Yep. They exist in nature. A cat is a cat. It's not just the human mind organizing things to make nature tidier. These things really exist because God created them that way.
Yeah, it matters in everything. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, the recent show we did on economics, and, you know, everyone assumes because if you're against distributism, you're all about like just usury and oppressing people and sweatshops and fiat currency. And I think people totally misunderstand that we're 100% opposed to usury, sweatshops and fiat currency. But even with money, fiat currency, the American government prints money and you hold up a dollar bill and you're like, what is this? Well, it's just nominalism.
Right.
You just say it's worth something and you all believe us. But it's not associated with gold or silver or buckskins or anything tangible or real. You just, it's kind of just all in our imagination and we just say it means something.
Right.
That's obviously a problem because they can just print more of them every day and deflate it.
Right.
Or inflate it. Right. I'm sorry.
No, it is not. That's an interesting take. It is pure nominalism. Having a Federal Reserve and a federally set interest rate. Oh, yeah, it's a whole different thing, but that is nominalism.
That's nominalism,
Everything
too.
Is nominalism. Yeah.
Yeah. Saying that someone who crosses geographically over the border de facto becomes a citizen of the nation is nominalism.
Right.
Like, almost everything in the leftist agenda is just, well, it is so because we say so. It's not rooted in reality.
There's no better semi-popularized instantiation of this principle then, and I'm not trying to joke because cancer is obviously serious, but now the new cancer commercials say, at least out here in California, for breast cancer, fight like a girl. It's like, this is offensive. This expression means something. You can't nominalistically just take this expression and say, well, politically now we want to invert nature and make this into a good thing to fight like a girl. It's not a desideratum to fight like a girl. You want to fight like a very, very tough man. I don't want any of the females in my life or in your life or in anybody's life to fight like a girl. If they get breast cancer, I want them fighting like a man. That is nominalism. Right. That right there.
Yeah.
You can't just do that. And that is what the left does. Leftism operates on nominalism. You talked about one day when we were talking about my book off the record, you were like, yeah, nominalism is always associated with like bad revolutions, with Jacobinist type revolutions. I forget exactly what you said, but it's true because they're always revolutions based on nominalist lies, the kind that popular uprisings that are not good.
Yeah.
One thing I'm trying to do.
Or Marx, socialism. All these people are equal. And we are just going to say they're all equal and they all have the same amount of money. They all have the same thing. Well, that's not true.
No,
it's not true.
Egalitarianism is nominalism. Exactly. Because, and this is one thing I also address in the book. We address it with the distributists. I address distributism partly in chapter 5 of the book. Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle, two guys I go to for anything. Thomas is my number one. Aristotle is my number two. They usually agree, except where Thomas corrected Aristotle, but they agree that egalitarianism, saying that everyone's equal, aside from saying everyone should have equal opportunity, we do believe in that. That comes from the dignity of man and the imago Dei. But to say everyone's actually equal, there aren't different kinds, more talented people that were given more talents, silver talents, if you want to use Matthew's gospel, is a flat lie. Egalitarianism is utopianism. It's humanist. It's Masonic. It's secularist. Yeah. It's a lie that there are different sorts. I mean, there's a natural aristocracy of naturally talented people. And there's the few and the many. And this does, maybe we're all equal in God's eyes. We are at the end of time. But on earth, there is a natural aristocracy. And if you start saying no, then you get into bad economics, bad politics, bad culture, secularism, humanism, masonry.
It's obvious in sports. I mean, we use this all the time. Not everyone can dunk. So we recognize that in sports. Why can't we recognize it in economics or in education or in schooling? I mean, there are people with higher IQs. There are people who are better at speaking, better at science, better at experimentation. They are. Just accept it. It's okay. We don't have to fudge it and pretend that everyone is equal when it comes to certain areas of human living.
Right. Not everyone's a college man. Not everyone needs to be.
Everyone needs to go to college. We need more people celebrating trade schools. It's good.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's very good. I want a good plumber. I don't want my plumber an expert in Dante or Homer. Right. I want an expert in pipes. He can read all that on the side too, but that's what I'm paying him for.
But if he's an expert in Dante, then it means that the economy has misplaced him. The best part of a specialized economy, this is another thing you don't get in distributism. I do talk about this in chapter 5 of my book, is an economy locates the most talent for a given function, a given job or occupation. And if your plumber were a really, really great Dante scholar, this has happened, Goodwill Hunting type situations, right. then – eventually he'll be like, well, I can get paid more to not just moonlight as a Dante scholar, but if I'm really good, I can daylight as a Dante scholar. Yeah. And the economy, if it's a good free enterprise economy where he's not being forced to buy or not buy or work or not work the way all kinds of collectivist schemes will have him do, if it's a good free enterprise economy, it will let him find that job that the economy will select him, market conditions will select him because yeah. he's so good at it. And if you've heard don't quit your day job, right? Don't quit your day job means you can study Dante, but you should keep being a plumber for reasons of right. market preference.
Yeah. Because you can't just say, well, that guy teaches Dante at the college. I should be able to teach Dante at the college. It doesn't right. work that way. It's a meritocracy. You know where this comes through? Someone pointed out to me is in music. You know, you got your phone and you listen to Spotify or whatever. Imagine if the government regulated the music that you had to listen to. Right. Like, well, I really want to listen to Taylor Swift. And I'm like, well, that's not fair. She has too many downloads. We're going to make you listen to this other girl from Oklahoma.
Right. Right.
And you have to listen to her. Well, I don't want to listen to her. I want to listen to Taylor Swift. Sorry, you have to listen to her. It's not fair that she has that many downloads. Or if you said, I want to listen to Mozart from the Philadelphia Orchestra. It's like, well, they have too many downloads. You got to listen to the one from Nebraska.
Right.
Like, imagine if the government actually made us do that to make all listening downloads fair. And then just extend that to everything in the world. And that's what the egalitarians want to do.
That's exactly right.
Or like, you want to watch NFL. It's like, well, you can't watch NFL. They have too many downloads. You have to watch the Pee Wee game down the street on TV.
Or CFL even.
Yeah, not, CFL.
It's a little more comparable.
Or you turn NBA and they're like, sorry, we blacked that out. You must watch WBA because they haven't had as many views this month. Yeah, you have to watch it.
I would revolt. Yeah, because that's revolting. Yeah, our household is the forum of many a WNBA joke. Here's my best WNBA joke. Go watch a highlight reel. Next question. You know, like, their highlight reels are hilarious. But yeah, that's exactly right. Sports, you know, my favorite analogy for big government, a centrally planned economy is this. We have a quality of opportunity in America. And that's why all sports games begin 0-0. That's the only sense in which equality is moral. But why do you pay money for a ticket to go to a football or a basketball game? Because you want to see an inequality as the outcome, right? You want to find out who's the best team. And the referee,
no one ever says that game was awesome. It tied.
It stayed tied no matter what. And dig this. This is the even deeper analogy to an unplanned economy or just a market economy and why it's best. What would it take for the referees, the federal government? Well, how active would they have to be to guarantee that the Golden State Warriors playing against the Phoenix Suns winds up a tie? They would have to be active little refs.
They'd have to be like, two guys go sit on the bench.
Right.
Yeah.
Or calling fouls when there wasn't, like, right. you know. A Phoenix Sun goes, Devin Booker goes up for a layup. He's the nearest defender is 3 feet away. And they're like, he scored the bucket and one. He gets a free throw. Like, I didn't even touch him. I wasn't even in the area. They're like, yeah, you were.
Doesn't matter.
I mean, it would be that level of
or telling the coach, you can't put him in. He's too successful.
That's right. That's right. Steph Curry and Kevin Durant have to sit on the bench.
Right.
They've had too much time.
Yeah.
They're too great of earners. Yeah. That's literally the refs are the central government to keep things equal.
Right.
And people would hate this in their sports, right? But we've been arguing with distributists the last 10 days that want a referee central government to be doing this to our sport, telling people, you know, Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, you got to sit on the bench, calling unfair fouls against the Warriors because they're the best team in basketball. I'm sad. I don't like it. I hate the Warriors, but my team can't beat them. Okay, so you can't get around them. But a fact's a fact. And when someone's the best, they deserve a non-equality. Egalitarianism, as Thomas Aquinas said very succinctly, is not right. It's wrong. It's a cry against justice. And I get, you get a bunch of analogies like this in my fifth chapter on family economy. That's actually what Aristotle wrote the ethics for, was a precursor to the politics. The politics is on the family economy. And he's basically describing free enterprise. One thing I'd like to just get in real fast, a plug for the book that I think people find most useful of all, is natural rights analysis and whether or not natural rights can be conceived of without a Catholic conception. And the answer is flatly, clearly, plainly, no. So the natural rights are life, liberty, property. And when they're violated, a fourth contingent one kicks in, the right of rebellion. Yeah. I want to start out this just by let me just ask you. Let me ask you what you think. Do you think people believe in the principle of the right of rebellion, 1776 principles, in 2019?
I don't. Yes or no? In Texas, many of them do. Where they would say, if we were invaded by the federal government, or if the federal government made us do this, we would polish our AR-15s and kill people. Which is Thomas Aquinas, which is Cicero, which is Judah Maccabee, which is, you know, Moses. I mean, that's the tradition, and I believe in it. But in the pews, at your just normal diocesan parish, 99% of the people wouldn't do that.
Or even in the suburbs with your kind of suburban paganism. Yeah. Or in the inner cities. It's not even just a question for Catholics. In the pews, I think most Catholics would say no. In the suburbs where you get the kind of suburban, softy paganism, they don't go to church on Sundays, they'd say no. In the urban hipsters, they'd say no. I feel like when people celebrate the principles of 1776, because, you know, it's something to celebrate, and they're barbecuing hot dogs on the 4th of July, they think it's a one and done deal. And one of the main ideas of the book, I've been contacted by several very interesting personages, let's say, over the idea that's celebrated in the book, the right of rebellion. President Jefferson wrote as president in 1801, he hoped this would happen often. Let the governors know that the people preserve the spirit of liberty. The only way to do it is to, from time to time, water the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots. What he means is literally governments always grow big and start taking away the other three natural rights of the people, life, liberty, and property. And so the connection, there is a causal connection between the right of liberty kicking in and the first three rights, life, liberty, property. What I suggest in the book, and it's not, you're talking about esotericism when we started out. I speak slightly esoterically, but it's more just subtly, because I'm saying, look, the founding fathers in 1775 and 1776 started tarring and feathering English lords, pouring hot tea down their throats, right? Dumping imported beverage, which is a major part of the economy in the North, in a Massachusetts bay, because there was a slight tariff on their breakfast beverage, right? Yeah. Without representation in the parliament. These were people that took rights very seriously, right? This is, which is a proper Catholic approach to it. These American colonists were serious. You put a slight tax on a freaking breakfast beverage, and we started doing this. They didn't have an income tax by Parliament, which we allowed with a constitutional amendment. They didn't have federalized abortion. You know, they didn't have federalized anything. All the individual state colonies, legislatures could decide. They had subsidiarity. They had what the goal is. Those colonies and even the first states after 1776 and after 1788, when we got the Constitution, they had real liberty. Today, we live with such a portion of that, a fraction of that, that any of these guys the smallest government guys, the anti-federalists, to slightly larger government guys, the federalists, would all say, oh, it's gone. This thing, the Republic it's gone. You're now the Roman Empire. Your rights, your natural rights are gone. And, you know, arguably this fourth right should be kicking in. Maybe it should have started kicking in about 100 years ago with the progressivist era under presidents like both Roosevelts, huge government guys, Woodrow right. Wilson, who wanted Big to get grabs. Rid of the Constitution. Yeah, unreal. Unreal how much water is under that bridge now. And we didn't have the revolution anytime after the Civil War. And now the government's just humongous. And now the Fed knows that it can get away. We American citizenry will suffer any amount of injustice, any amount of rights stripping of our life. There is no right to life, right? It's a right of death. No human American is born with a government, state-sanctioned right of life. We sure. are all born. I make this point very strongly in chapter one of the book. We have a right of death, not a right of life. It's been inverted. Everyone who's born is born by accident or by good choice of our mothers, that she chooses not to abort us. But even all of our fathers couldn't intervene and have kept our mothers from aborting us should our mothers have chosen right. to do this. It's
how
ghastly.
Sad. How sad is that?
It's pathetic. You look at
life, liberty, and property. The abortion industry is tax the life. Communism, socialism attacks the property and also the liberty, right? So these things are being eroding is too soft of a term. It's not just eroding; it's actively being taken out. I kind of wonder if we are on the verge of a major global catastrophe. I'm not talking about like a comet hitting us, but things are getting kind of crazy, especially in Europe. And you know, we'll see what happens in the next presidential election. But
that's what might precipitate it. Well, yeah. I mean, people might not know it because I seem like pretty, you know, maybe a combination of a serious guy and a laid back guy or whatever, but people might be surprised. No, I'm a bit of a prepper. I stock up on food storage.
Don't tell everyone that they're going to come to your house. You never admit that.
You're not supposed to. You really aren't. But that's the two sides that is Tim Gordon. The two you don't announce it, but
you don't announce that you have food stores at your house.
Yeah. No, yeah. You really shouldn't.
And just announce you have guns.
50,000 people.
Mountains of
ammo. Yeah, you're not even – my dad always told me don't even say you have guns. But I got lots of those and we've talked about that.
The problem is you live in California and you're just screwed. We have a fighting chance in Texas.
That's right. That's exactly right. Is a republic is based on the idea that you basically, you're as your neighborhood goes and your city and right. your immediate 30 miles square goes, exactly. so you go. And I'm in Sodom and Gomorrah. I'm in Mordor. Let's say that because that's a little more fun, even though dark. I'm in Mordor.
I'm kind of in the Shire. It's looking good here. I'm about to go eat second breakfast. You know.
I really want to get to Idaho for these purposes because not a prepper, but a prep minded person. Yeah. You want to get, I want to get somewhere where I can get a lot of land.
See, I know people who've gone to Montana and they like it out there, but I've also heard that there's a lot of weapons of mass destruction in Idaho and all of our enemies know that. So they've got just their nukes pointed at Montana.
Montana or Idaho? You said both. Montana.
Yeah.
Montana's cool. It's just too cold. It's too cold for me. Montana's amazing.
Idaho's pretty cold, man. It's right there with it.
Well, I mean, Boise's very warm. I mean, it's a large enough state with enough north-south that, we have a family cabin in McCall.
Okay.
And which is an amazing little area, which is 2 hours north of Boise. It's nice because you get the Four Seasons, but it's not so far north. You go all the way to like Moscow.
Yeah,
where the university is, and it is. My brother went to law school there.
Oh, at the Calvinist school?
Chilly. What's that?
The Calvinist school in Moscow?
Idaho.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's also a big Calvinist bastion up there in Moscow, Idaho.
Is there?
Yeah.
Is there really?
There's also a lot of trads popping up there. A lot of trad Catholics.
There's a trad high school in I forget the little city, but it's toward the northwest part of the state near Spokane. you know, Spokane's just over the border in Washington. There's a trad high school, which is there's an SSPX high school, which is a rare thing, even in places where you have the SSPX.
Really, out there. Interesting. Out there.
Huh. I think it's on the Washington side of the border. But Washington as a state is very conservative aside from Seattle.
Exactly.
Like East Washington is like super conservative, just like all of Idaho is. You also have a lot of Mormons there. But the point is you do want to be someplace where it's not enough to just storage, prep, guns, plan. A go bag. Yeah. Everyone should have a go bag. I don't know how we wound up talking about this, but you also need to be in a republic, because I'm talking about what a republic is. That's one of the things that I think this book does that preps people properly. A republic is not just a big nation where you live. A republic should be small. It should be peopled by citizens who are like-minded. So we're all Catholic. We all believe in this moral theology together. We're all motivated by the same things. Should be geographically small. And then
You don't want to live in an Antifa republic.
You don't. And if you live in Northern California, it's definitely Antifa republic. It's really important. But when you were wrestling over this idea, I think correctly, according to me, about life, liberty, property, it's not just that they've been, you said, perverted or something like that. That's too weak a word. You're right.
Eroded. Eroded's too weak.
Eroded, you said. They haven't just been eroded a bit. They've been inverted. So this is my chapter one. Check it out. The right of life. It's not just abortion at the beginning of life. It's euthanasia at the end of life.
Right.
Or even if you look at all the old folks' homes and the kind of conscience assuasion you got there, it's a soft version.
Yeah, like let's turn up the morphine a little bit more on everybody.
Yeah. Right. You have a right of death. And the reason people defend it so ardently is because of the responsibility that it puts on them. A right of liberty, which is ordered freedom. No, what culturally Americans believe in, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, 1992 abortion case, which held up Roe. You get that famous dicta from Justice Kennedy saying, basically, people's liberty so they can do whatever they want. That's not liberty. That's license. Liberty is ordered freedom. Right. License is non-ordered freedom. Liberty is, you know, you have the freedom to do the good the way you best think it. License is you just have freedom. It's not to pursue any specific good other than more freedom. They're actually opposites. That's what, I'm sorry to say, 2019 Americans mostly believe in. It's a pagan culture. They believe in license more than liberty. And property, well, we have something called common property. We have eminent domain, aggrandized, energized version of eminent domain. The government can take your property for not just public uses, but even public conceptions, public functions at any time.
Like a baseball stadium.
Right, like a baseball stadium. Yeah. Like that is not just a public, it's not a highway.
It's like we need a highway or a train track.
Right.
Or a power line. Yeah.
A mall. There's a very famous case. Right. Kelo versus City of New London, 2005. A mall, a shopping mall. It's we have our rights inverted. And I argue and I show why. I show how. In some. It's because when you have Protestants and secular enlightenment type thinkers secretly reading Catholic philosophy, you get stuff largely right. But you don't get it right in a high profile way. You get it right in a low profile way that quickly descends.
Yeah.
And so now we have, you know, I say America's the Republic wired Catholic, labeled Protestant, and currently functioning secular. You get this degradation from Catholic ideas, Protestant labeling, to basically secular functioning. This is what happens unless the solution is you say, even if everyone in the whole Republic is not Catholic, which would be ideal, what you at least need to do is label the ideas properly as Catholic so you're not plagiarizing. I show how this has the effect of what good would labeling do? When things start to go awry, you can correct as needed. So that's the thesis of the book, Catholic Republic, bounced around a lot. Super happy, super grateful to the good people at Sophia Institute Press to have it coming out in 2 weeks. You can pre-order it now. And they actually think it will get there early. So you'll get your copy before April 18th, they think now.
Nice.
That never was the case at Dangerous. Right. As thankful as I am to Milo Yiannopoulos for publishing it, he really helped me out. And had some good times at some good sales at Dangerous, but I really appreciate how on top of things Sophia is. It's a top-notch imprint, and I know both you and I are excited to be part of the team.
Yeah, that's right. So get it. You can get it at Sophia Institute Press, the website. Amazon has it too. There's the Kindle version up on Amazon, but I think if you get it at Sophia, that helps out Sophia. So we push that. And I don't have the new one to hold up, but there's the old one. Go check it out. Support Tim, support his family, and everybody, thanks for watching. If you enjoy these videos, this is a different one, but like it, subscribe it, hit the bell, and thanks for all your continued support, and get that book.